Lynn Rossetto Casper with the Splendid Table. American cheese, and we all think big blocks of mild orange cheese. Not bad, but these days there's a lot more to American cheese, like California Telemé, so creamy you eat it with a spoon. Our guest today, Laura Werlin, introduces us to the new American cheesemakers. These folks have started a renaissance. Jane and Michael Stern are in South Carolina scarfing up pig aplenty platters. That genius with herbs, Chef Jerry Traunfeld, talks marjoram. And tea expert Bill Waddington introduces us to the display teas of China. All this and your calls coming up on the Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with Kitchen Chronicles, where knowledge is power and cooking is pleasure, a practical guide to nourishing ourselves and the people we care about. If your farmer's market is like mine, green beans are practically jumping off the tables into your arms. They're coming into high season, and I figure green beans need a break. They get ignored at this time of year, even though they're in their prime. They come into season at the same time their flashy cousins do, corn and tomatoes. So most folks neglect the green bean. Now, green beans go beautifully with corn and tomatoes, but they're pretty delicious on their own, too. So here's some ideas of what to do with a pound of green beans. These aren't recipes as much as concepts, places to begin improvising. First, let's buy the beans. Figure that 1 pound of green beans serves 3 to 4 people. Check out organic beans if you can. But always be sure the beans look crisp, not wilted or limp. There should be no dark spots on them, and check their tips. Where the bean ends, you know, where it comes to a point, if that end is wilted or darkened, they've been off the plant too long. And here's another tip. Super fresh beans are still fuzzy. If you see them, snap them up. Now, the next thing to do is to taste one. Most farmers really don't mind if you do this. Break the bean. It should be crisp. And then take a bite. It should be sweet. It should taste good. Green beans stay in their prime in the refrigerator for about 3 or 4 days. Make sure they're dry. You don't wash them until just before cooking. And store them in an airtight plastic bag. The simplest way to cook a green bean is to steam it or boil it. This way you get a pure, gentle bean flavor. I had this revelation about boiled green beans when I was staying on my cousin's farm in Tuscany. Every night she picked beans from the garden and she boiled them. They came to the table at room temperature and we ate them how we pleased. Now in Tuscany that usually means sprinkled with the farm's own olive oil and some salt and pepper. The beans were so good, I would finish off whatever was left as we cleared the table. When I thought about it, I realized that there was something different here. The beans were cooked slightly beyond that tender, crisp stage we usually use here in the States, and they were sweeter for it. The other difference was salt. They were cooked in really salty water, and then they were tossed with salt while they were still hot. Now, we make them that way all the time now at home, and they're as good as they are in Tuscany. We found everybody likes to eat them with their fingers with drinks, and kids like them, too. Now, all you do is drop a pound of whole green beans, I just trim away that hard stem end, into boiling salted water. You boil them uncovered until they're tender with just a little resistance. You drain them, and while they're still hot, you toss them with some good sea salt, and then you serve them at room temperature. Now, you could take those same beans and toss them with fresh herbs like lemon thyme leaves, or make a green bean and cousins salad. Mix the green beans with those cousins, the corn and the tomatoes. Scrape some cooked corn from the cob, dice up some tomatoes, and thinly slice lots of scallions. Toss that with the cooked green beans in a sweet sour dill dressing. I just found some really fragrant ground cumin at the market, and that led me to another great way to cook green beans. This is a dish you would serve at room temperature. You start out with browning the beans. Now, if boiling brings out a pure, delicate taste, browning makes the beans bolder. They taste more like a main dish. So you brown up your pound of green beans with lots of cut-up red onion, salt and pepper, and you put that in a big, shallow pan. I use olive oil for the browning. Now, season the sauté with lots of chopped-up garlic, a generous teaspoonful of ground cumin, and a little fresh hot chili and a big handful of fresh basil leaves. Cook everything for a few minutes until you can smell all those herbs. Add tomato and water, cook until tender, and serve it up. So don't ignore the green beans. Pick up a pound, make yourself some good food, and join us again for the next Kitchen Chronicles. Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, offering the latest cooking tools and gadgets, from colanders to ladles to timers and garlic crushers. Target has the selection of cooking tools to fully outfit your kitchen. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Vagley Productions and is distributed by PRI Public Radio International. You probably already know this. To eat great cheese, you don't have to buy imports. We have some pretty sensational cheeses in the United States. Many of them are made by hand by a new wave of American cheesemakers. Our guest today is Laura Werland. She's author of The New American Cheese. She has some recommendations for us, and she also has a tale or two about the cheesemakers themselves, like the country doctor in Virginia who figured her border collies needed something to do, so she got them some sheep to herd, and that led to her making some pretty fine sheep cheese. Herbs are going nuts at this time of year. Whether you garden or just shop, they are in their prime. So that genius with herbs, Chef Jerry Traunfeld, is back. This time he's going to tell us all about marjoram. Now, you don't hear a lot about this herb, but Jerry's going to change all that. Our favorite tea expert, Bill Waddington, is dropping by. Now, we always taste different teas with Bill, but this time it's a real puzzler. He says he wants us to learn about something called display teas. Do you just look and not sip? We're going to find out. We have a visit with the Spice Hunter, a woman who tracks down spices around the world. And as always, in the second half of the show, we open the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's get started with that road food duo, Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Two for the Road column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, where have you guys been wandering?
We have been wandering down to Spartanburg, South Carolina, and Lynn, it's hot down there. And because it's hot and because I'm always thirsty, the first place Michael and I head for is the Beacon Drive-In, where they sell more iced tea than any other restaurant in the world.
You're kidding? No. More iced tea?
Yes.
Yes,
and you have to understand that this is Southern-style iced tea, meaning it is pre-sweetened. And when I say pre-sweetened, it's really pre-sweetened. Extremely sweet. It's served in gigantic cups with lots of shaved ice. It really is one of the most cooling beverages you can imagine.
It's kind of like glucose with, you know, tea flavoring in it.
But wait, we're missing, I mean, wonderful as the tea is, there is so much more to the Beacon Drive-In.
Like what?
Yes. For one thing, the Beacon is the kind of place that still has car hop service. One of the car hops, a man named Ezell Jackson, is 91 years old, and he is still an active car hop.
He's been doing it for 50 years.
You're kidding. I'm 91 years old.
And the Beacon specializes, food-wise, aside from enormous vats of sweet iced tea, in their something a plenty platter. Now, this can be chicken a plenty, fish a plenty.
Or, best yet, pork a plenty, because this is real pork barbecue, southern-style barbecue. And the chili cheese aplenty is probably the most popular dish in the house, which is a chili cheeseburger heaped, I mean buried, underneath piles of sweet onion rings and French fried potatoes. But we still haven't told you the best thing about the Beacon, which is not dining in your car. It's going inside. It's a huge drive-in and going through the line. Walk the line, they call it. You walk into the Beacon drive-in and there will be a man there who virtually accosts you to know what you want to eat. And if you don't shout out what you want to eat within, say, 5 seconds of that man accosting you, he moves on to the next person in line.
This man is J.C. Strobel, who has also been at the Beacon for as long as anybody eating there can remember. JC is legally blind, but he has an encyclopedic and photographic, I guess, memory of what people order. He also has the loudest voice I have ever heard in my entire life. So when you go in, JC gets right up in your face and he said, "Call it out. What are you having?" And, you know, I freeze. Michael says, you know, I'm going to have
pork aplenty.
Pork aplenty, chicken aplenty, you know, 2 big iced teas, O-rings fries, banana mayo sandwich on white bread that Elvis would have loved.
Banana mayo sandwiches.
On white bread.
All right, I'm with you.
And JC, I mean, literally, and this is not just Jane Stern hyperbole, but thousands of people a day come through this place, especially on the weekends, and JC remembers every order and screams it out at the top of his lungs across the restaurant to the short order cooks who then prepare it and send it out to you in your car.
And the thing is, once he calls out that order, he says, "Walk the line," and so you're out of his face, and literally you walk down the it's like a cafeteria line with your tray. Literally within 30 seconds, the order that he has called out to the open kitchen appears before you. It is so fast, you really don't have time to reach for your wallet.
And Lynn, we were there 2 weeks ago, and that day we were there, I think, on a Saturday, and they served 5,000 people in one day. And JC remembered every single order. It's a phenomenal place.
You know, this sounds like a hoot, but is the food worthwhile?
The food is great, great drive-in food, all cooked from scratch, wonderful pork barbecue, terrific cheeseburgers, I mean, onion rings, seconds out of the fryolator. It's fresh, it's fast, it's great American drive-in food.
But one thing, if you can't conjure up your order for JC, do you just lose your place and have to start all over again?
You step out of line, and usually people are polite enough to let you back in line, and the line moves about the speed of a platoon on a forced march, so there's no problem getting in line again.
Hey, you too, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Eat Your Way Across the USA. Every week you can hear them right here on the Splendid Table, and every week you can get their food finds on our website at splendidtable.org. The herbs out there are in their prime. Even if you live on takeout, just try tearing up a few herb leaves over that salad bar salad. The fragrance is incredible. But of course there's more. I mean, what do you expect? This is a food show. Jerry Traunfeld is a genius with herbs. He's been stopping by a lot this summer. This man is the chef at the Herb Farm restaurant near Seattle. Now, this is the place that opens its lines for reservations only twice a year, and it's filled in a matter of hours. Jerry's also author of the Herb Farm Cookbook. Jerry, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Jerry, I want to talk to you today about marjoram, because I think this is one of the stepchildren of the herb family. You never see it used, or it's used very rarely. What do you do with marjoram?
Oh, I love marjoram. You know, it's a cousin to oregano. It's in the same genus, but whereas oregano is sort of very brash tasting, and it's very hot and fiery, marjoram is kind of like the refined cousin, you know? And it has this wonderful, it's still pungent, but it has a wonderful perfume. And I think it goes with so many different foods, especially in the summer. I like to really think of herbs seasonally, just like other foods, and marjoram is in full growth in the summer, and it goes really well with summer vegetables. I love to use it with tomatoes and corn and summer squash, but it also goes great with grilled foods, with chicken, with many seafoods, particularly clams or with shrimp. When I roast shrimp in the shell, I'll add some marjoram, toss with a little bit of marjoram, and then roast it in a hot oven, and it's just terrific. It's also great with clams. I'll put it in a clam chowder, creamy clam chowder, and it's really out of this world. So it's got so many different aspects to it, and it is sort of forgotten. Sometimes you'll see it in the supermarket in the little packages next to oregano, but it really has a whole different character.
I have some in my garden, and trust me, if anything grows for me, you know, it's a miracle. And you can't kill this stuff. I mean, it keeps coming back every year.
Well, you must have loose soil, too. But, you know, the true sweet marjoram, it's also called knotty marjoram, is an annual, so you really have to plant it every year. I have a feeling what you might have in your garden, Lynn, is Italian oregano, which is almost the same. It tastes very similar, but it's a perennial.
Oh, really? Yes, all these years. But now, is there a real difference with marjoram between the dried and the fresh?
There is. You know, I cook primarily with fresh herbs, but marjoram keeps some of its flavor when it's dried, but just like any herb, it loses most of its essential oils, so you're just left with sort of a generic flavor, but you lose all the nuance.
If I want to use it in mixing it with other herbs, are there certain other things it really goes well with?
Well, I like to use it with some of the other Mediterranean herbs. It goes well with rosemary. It goes well with mint and with thyme. Other herbs that have quite a bit of pungency to them, it seems to marry with.
Jerry, I tend to divide herbs into two categories, the blending herbs, you know, the herbs that if you overdo it, they're not going to kill a dish, and what I think of as accent herbs, the ones that if you overdo it, they're just too much. Where does marjoram fall?
Marjoram is an accent herb. You can overdo it because it can be very pungent. And actually, the flavor varies quite a bit. In the hot weather, it gets much stronger. And in the cool weather, it's a little bit more mild. But, you know, a great way to use it where it sort of mellows it and makes it a little more subtle is I have a great recipe for corn where I take, when I'm grilling corn on the cob in a kettle grill, I'll peel back the husk of the corn, put a little soft butter on the kernels, and then put whole sprigs on top of the butter, and then peel back the husk so it's sort of sandwiched in between the kernels and the husk, and then grill it. And as you grill it, the marjoram just infuses throughout the corn, and it's just really out of this world.
It sounds so good. Jerry, thank you.
Thank you.
Jerry Traunfeld is author of the Herb Farm Cookbook. You can get his recipe for grilled marjoram-scented corn on our website at splendidtable.org. Coming up, an inside look at the new wave of cheesemaking in America, complete with some exceptional ones to check out, tea expert Bill Waddington with the display teas of China, and, of course, your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Target, dedicated to helping you discover new and exciting ideas that help you enjoy everything there is about cooking for your friends and family, just like you do here at The Splendid Table each week, online at Target.com. Cheese is back. People are serving cheese trays instead of dessert. Even the selection in the supermarkets is getting better. I love this. After years of avoiding cheese because of the fat, we're finally being honest with ourselves and admitting how satisfying a little exceptional cheese can be. Now the question is, how to find the exceptional cheese? It used to be you had to buy the imports. Not anymore. Artisan-made American cheeses are standing up to the imports, sometimes taking international prizes. Our guest today is Laura Werlin. She's author of The New American Cheese, Profiles of America's Great Cheesemakers. She says artisan cheeses have really blossomed. 10 years ago, there were a handful of cheese artisans. Now there's over 200. Laura, welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Laura, what does this word artisan actually mean?
Well, according to Webster's, it's a person skilled in an applied art or a craftsperson. And that definition absolutely fits that of today's American cheesemaker. They are indeed craftspeople because they are making these cheeses by hand in large part, not exclusively, but in large part. And they are doing it from start to finish with little to no mechanization.
Now, when you say they're making them entirely by hand, this is a very different approach to cheese making than most cheese production in the United States, right?
Absolutely. There are two kind of definitions. There is the artisan-made cheese, and then there is what we know of as specialty cheese, which can also be quite fantastic, but it may or may not be touched by human hands.
Mm-hmm.
And so artisan cheese is that which is, as I said before, made by hand, and it is a throwback to our early, early days in this country of making cheese when, of course, we didn't have mechanization.
You know, there's something I see on labels of these artisan-made American cheeses, occasionally the word farmstead. Is that just sort of advertising, or does it have a meaning?
No, it absolutely has a meaning. It's very specific, and what that refers to is cheese made from the milk of the cheesemaker's own animals. So in other words, when the cheesemaker is making his or her cheese, he or she is drawing the milk exclusively from the animals on his or her farm. He or she, again, is not buying the milk from anyone.
Uh-huh. So some people are buying milk.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Most cheesemakers are very, very picky about the milk that they use to make their cheese. And so, generally speaking, they use very, very high-quality milk. Of course, there's more control if they're using their own milk, but farmstead is very specifically cheese made from that farm's milk.
Well, okay, now tell us about several of these cheesemakers, maybe people we probably haven't heard of.
Mm-hmm. Well, because cheesemaking spans the continent from, or beyond the continent, from Hawaii to Maine, there are many. In Hawaii, there's Kuokoa Farms. These are people who came from the mainland, went to Hawaii, live in a remote part, and got some goats and began making goat cheese. And they've been making very highly regarded goat cheese for all of the chefs in Hawaii.
Huh.
Moving inland, if you will, to the center of our country in Greenville, Indiana, near Louisville, Kentucky, Judy Shad has been making cheeses under the Caprio label for, 15 years or maybe more. And Judy is one of the finest cheesemakers I think we have in this country. She has really perfected the art of goat cheese making, and she makes beautiful, beautiful cheeses from her crocodile tears, which are these wonderful tear-shaped cheeses that have a lining of paprika. So when you cut them open, there's just this thin line of orange line that makes them look beautiful, but it also tastes wonderful. And she's constantly developing new cheeses with her goat's milk. And she's taken an unusual path. She's gone from buying her milk and buying the hay to feed the goats and all of that to really becoming a farmstead operation. She does almost all of the growing of her hay. All of the milk comes from her own goats now, and because she is really wanting to have more and more control over the quality of her product, and it really shows. There's a cheesemaker named Pat Elliott in a place called Rapidan, Virginia. Pat came to cheesemaking in sort of an unusual way. She had two border collie dogs, and she looked around and decided that her dogs needed something to do. So with that, she decided to get a few sheep to give them something to push around, I guess. And once she had the sheep, she decided that, have sheep, make cheese. And that's what she does at night. During the day, she is a doctor. She is a general practitioner there in the country. And then at night, like I say, she makes this wonderful aged raw milk sheep's milk cheese that is definitely worth getting your hands on if you can.
Well, what's it called?
It's called Everona. In California, a woman named Mary Keene has been making cheeses under the Cypress Grove label, and her most well-known cheese is something called Humboldt Fog, which is this beautiful cheese that is separated by a line of edible vegetable ash. And when you cut open the cheese, you just have this thin line in between these two pillows of beautiful white cheese, and goat's milk is very, very white, and that's why the cheese looks white.
Uh-huh.
And Mary really had the struggle to get where she is today. She had four daughters. She was not married, and she was going to hang it all up. And about a week before she had decided to hang it all up, somebody kind of shoved a piece of her cheese into a cheese distributor's mouth, and he went crazy for it. And that not only kept her alive, from there she has flourished. And that is not atypical of many cheesemakers' stories around this country. It is not an easy lifestyle, I will tell you.
A lot of women.
Well, yes, that's really true. I mean, I can give you some examples, and I will, of some men. But if you look at cheesemaking and its history in our country, for the most part, it was started and continued by women. In fact, in the state of Wisconsin, which, of course, we think of as a cheese-producing state because it is, the farmers there were very much against becoming dairy farmers. To them, that was women's work. But their wheat and other crops were not paying the bills anymore. So, and dairy would, but they really, really resisted it until they had no choice.
You better give us a few token men, I think.
Well, this is not a token man. This is a real one. But there is a man named Jules Wesseling. He has a company called Winchester Cheese Company in Southern California. And Jules is now about 71, 72 years old. And he began making cheese, 5 years ago, something like that. And he was a dairy farmer for 40 years and decided that he wanted to begin to make cheese. And he's from Holland and came from a family of cheesemakers, though he himself had never made cheese. So he went back to Holland, learned how to make cheese, then came back to California, and is now making what I consider to be the best Gouda made in this country. He ages it for 10 to 12 months, and it's kind of Parmesan in style. It's a little crumbly, and it's a little salty, and it's so flavorful. And it is not like the red wax Gouda you think of being in this country,
yeah.
Let me tell you. There are couples who make cheese, so that includes the men, of course. In Vermont, there's Blythedale Farm, and they have just 20 Jersey cows, and from that they make a wonderful brie and camembert and a particularly good blue cheese that they call Jersey Blue that's very, very much like English Stilton, and it's only one of about two or three Stilton-like cheeses, at least that I know of, made in this country.
Laura, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sunday means we're grocery shopping, my girlfriend and me. If morning finds us tired and hungry, we might not agree. Sometimes we bicker badly in the baked goods. In frozen foods, our hearts frequently freeze. In cereals, we speak serious in discussions. But we always make a blend when we hear the cheese. We always make a blend when we hear the cheese.
Laura Werlin is author of The New American Cheese, Profiles of America's Great Cheesemakers. You can get information on the cheeses she mentioned and her recipe for herbed sugar snap peas with goat cheese two ways. Either mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or go to our website at splendidtable.org.
Now this is serious. One thing in this country that really bothers me is the inability of banks to make a good cup of tea. Instructions are printed on the tea bag, but they either can't read or they think it's a gag. I mean, pour boiling water over the tea. How simple and clear can instructions be?
To avoid the scorn of the Brits, our resident tea expert, Bill Waddington, has joined me in the studio to educate us about tea. Bill, good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. It's nice to be here.
So, Bill, what are we going to talk about today?
I thought it would be fun to talk about a whole category, a group of teas that are sometimes referred to as display teas or presentation teas. They're teas that are renowned for their visual and aesthetic appeal as much as they are for their taste.
Wait a minute. Are these sort of the pinup girls or the... No, but I'm picturing, you know, a display tea? How does this work?
Well, again, it's a tea that, as you brew it, at least half the enjoyment of the tea and the pleasure you get from the tea is through watching what happens to the leaf itself or the tea as it steeps.
Huh. Now, where are they coming from?
Primarily, display teas and presentation teas are coming from China. And there are literally dozens and dozens and dozens of different styles, shapes, sizes, forms of display and presentation teas.
Is this sort of a new idea?
No, this goes back literally thousands of years. The Chinese have been doing things with tea that we haven't even begun to find out about yet.
Huh. So this is a tradition. I mean, are these like special occasion teas?
They can be special occasion teas. Sometimes they can just be very utilitarian teas that, as part of that utility, developed a particular form or shape that was a beauty in its own right.
Can you show me some examples?
Sure. I'll show you one of the most dramatic of a presentation teas. It's probably the only tea in the world I know of that can actually clunk if you drop it.
I don't know if you can hear this, but Bill has just handed me a rectangle. It's got to weigh at least a pound, maybe more. It is about, I'd say 7 by 10. It's about an inch thick. It is pressed. It's tea, but it's beautifully embossed. I mean, this is a piece of artwork.
It is.
And what is this, Bill?
It's called a tea brick.
Oh, and there are squares on the back. It's almost like Mahjong pieces.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So you can break off chunks. It is a tea brick. It's compressed tea, very finely ground tea dust, usually compressed with some sort of medium, often something like a plum juice. It literally goes back probably more than 1,000 years. It's from northern China, Mongolia. They needed a way to have tea that would transport easily on camelback and not take a lot of room, but also preserve very long, a long time. So when they compressed it, locks all the air out, uses spaces very effectively, and a byproduct was then they started creating artwork out of it.
It has this bas relief. I would frame this.
A lot of people will just throw a coat of varnish on it and frame it. I think it's actually
absolutely beautiful. All right, but is this good tea?
Is it good tea? It's the kind of tea you would drink a cup of if you were going to storm the Great Wall of China this morning. It's strong, slightly bitter. It will get you going. Typically, I don't know anyone who drinks it straight. Typically, it's drunk with yak butter, maybe a little pinch of salt, something to cut the tea. It's a pretty potent tea.
To drink it, first you have to get your yak.
Yeah, that's about it.
Okay, so what else? Oh, what's this?
This is a tea called Green Peony Rosettes.
This looks like I took long grass fronds and tied them in the middle and made something that looked like a little dried dust mop. This is exactly what it looks like, a dried flower. And that's why they call it peony, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but now, Is it actually a peony?
No, it's not. It's tea leaves. So there's no peony or flower in it at all.
There's a lot of work to this, Bill.
It is. It's dried individual tea leaves mm-hmm. that have been hand-tied together with silk and thread.
Yeah.
And literally all you would do is drop them in a glass, and then it'll bloom like a peony would.
And you have them in a stemmed wine glass.
What my wife and I like to do sometimes after a meal when we have someone over is, instead of serving an after dinner coffee, pull out wine glasses, drop a green peony rosette in each goblet, and then add hot water, and you can start to watch the peony blossom. And that blossoming, that unfurling of the leaf in China, is referred to as the agony of the leaves, that the leaves start to unfurl as they rehydrate.
What a great way to end a meal.
Let me drop one of these green peony rosettes in some warm water. It's green tea, so you're not going to use boiling water, but let me just drop it in some warm water for you. And it'll slowly start to bloom. It'll slowly start to blossom.
It's beautiful. It's opening up, and it's getting larger. Can I taste it?
Absolutely.
Oh, it smells like flowers. Bill, that's delicious. That's very delicate.
Very delicate.
And flowery. I know it's tea, but I guess the suggestion is there. Bill, thank you. This is wonderful. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Lynn.
Bill Waddington owns the Tea Source in St. Paul, Minnesota. You can get information on Bill's display teas on our website at splendidtable.org. The lines have opened. Get on the phone, folks. Give us a call. The number is 800-537-5252. We will talk about anything you want to talk about. Let's get right to the phones. We've got Reva on the line. Hey, Reva, what do you want to talk about?
All right. I have these wonderful Beacon Hill cookies that I make. They're a meringue cookie, and they're so successful. They're really great. And they have a little bit of vinegar in them. And I just wondered, I always make these, and they're so great. And I wonder, why do they put a tiny bit of vinegar into the meringue? Can you tell me that?
Yeah, well, it's vinegar is in a meringue, which is beaten egg whites,
mm-hmm.
for the same reason you might use cream of tartar.
I see.
It's an acid, and evidently the acid helps strengthen the protein in the egg whites, and it just helps. It helps the meringue sort of hold up a little longer when you're beating it, and maybe have to let it sit for a few minutes. It doesn't make it get any bigger, you know.
No, but it gives it staying power.
Exactly, it strengthens those protein strands that sort of get stretched out and hold air bubbles, and that's why you would use a little bit of vinegar or some cream of tartar.
Wonderful. Well,
Sounds like a good recipe. Is it from Boston? Is it really from Beacon Hill? Do you know?
I don't know. You know what? If you like, I will send it to you because it's really so. It's just so easy, and it takes, you know, as long as it takes to beat up the egg whites and melt the the chips. It's just such a simple recipe, and everyone loves it.
Just sounds good. Hey, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And we'll all be eating them, and we'll be getting fat, but that's okay. Reva, thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Lynn.
Goodbye.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. And this week, I've been thinking about portion sizes. As we Americans keep expanding, meaning growing bigger and bigger, we keep puzzling over why. Well, a lot of people are taking a look at the size of the portions we eat. So today's question is, what do you think the official USDA food pyramid defines as a portion of pasta? We'll be back with that answer in a moment, and we'll get back to your calls. So go to those phones. The number is 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is The Splendid Table, distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. Rosetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. It's open lines for your calls this hour at 800-537-5252, but first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia question. The question was about portion size. As we Americans continue to grow, that's larger and heavier, and keep puzzling over why, portion size keeps rearing its head. How much are we really eating? So today's question was, what does the official USDA food pyramid define as a portion of pasta? Hang on to your forks. It's 1/2 cup. That's about 1/6 the amount you find in the average bowl of pasta in a restaurant. In fact, for most people, 1/2 cup of pasta is not a portion. It's an afterthought. Lisa Young is a nutritionist at New York University who did her PhD dissertation on portion sizes. Now, she says that evidently things started to go bonkers back in the 1980s. Do you know that the average muffin back then weighed 2 ounces and was about 190 calories? The average muffin today is 4 ounces with 430 calories. And mega muffins, weighing in at a hefty 8 ounces, are becoming the norm. That's 800 calories. That's the amount of calories you could eat in a good supper. Now, speaking of 800 calories, the 7-Eleven store's popular drink, it's called the Double Gulp, that has 800 calories, and you're not even chewing on something. Now, supposedly, if we were to sit down to the average restaurant plate from the 1970s tonight, we'd think we were being cheated. But, you know, we really shouldn't be beating ourselves up over falling for all this excess. All of these big portions spell profits for the food manufacturers. They want us to literally buy into the idea that more is more. And they've got us where we can't hold back. Most supersized foods are all about the big three of lusciousness: fat, sugar, and salt. Even dietitians, now these guys lie awake at nights thinking about portion sizes, even when you sit down a group of dietitians to some oversized meals, they can't tell they're eating more than they need. So folks, it's a puzzle. Let's get back to the phones. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's see, who have we got on the line? We've got Bill on the line. So, Bill, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I'm glad to, thanks for letting me have a chance to ask this question.
We charge for this, Bill.
Yeah, right.
Okay,
well,
but go ahead.
I only have one question.
Okay.
Several years ago, I was living and working in Mexico. I was there for about 3 years in a town up in the mountains about 20 miles from Mexico City called Toluca. It's the capital of the state of Mexico. And they had something that was sold on the street corners, usually in the evenings, called atole, atole, A-T-O-L-E. It was a really, really delicious, hot, had different flavors, drink that was served out of a large earthenware jug, usually sitting on a table, and for about 2 pesos a cup. And it seemed to be just throughout Mexico, but in all my excursions around New York City to find Mexican food, I've never found it in any of the Mexican restaurants here in New York City.
What does it taste like?
Well,
is it sweet?
It's sweet, yeah. It's sweet. It's hot. It has a thickness, and I think it may have maybe some milk in it. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, this is what I know about atole, and it, trust me, this is not an encyclopedic discussion here.
Right.
I know it's supposedly a very, very old drink. I mean, it predates when the Spaniards came to Mexico.
Like Aztec.
That's what I understand.
I think it is, yeah.
And one of the ways it's made is it's made with what's called masa harina, which you're probably familiar with having lived in Mexico. But for those who aren't, this is ground corn. It's cornmeal, mm-hmm. but the corn has been treated with slaked lime. In some words, the dried
right.
kernels have been soaked. And that's
like
where you
the
get
tortillas,
that.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's mm-hmm. that perfumey smell that you get from a corn tortilla.
Maybe that's it, yeah.
Well, that's the sign that the corn has been treated with the lime. And evidently that mixture of the corn and moist, you know, in water, which is called masa harina,
right,
is cooked in milk or water with sugar. But then flavorings can be added to it. Supposedly you can put chili in it, you can put fruit in it, you could put chocolate in it.
Right. Well, this is what they used to do. They had either sometimes a chocolate, they have a vanilla, sometimes they have a sort of a strawberry flavor.
Right,
sometimes
right.
Some other flavor, yeah.
Well, if you can get, I'll bet you can make this.
Hmm?
You know, I'll bet you you can make this. I think
probably. I just don't know the amounts, you know, and that stuff. And
now that I'm not sure about because
I think that would be fairly important.
Yeah, well, yeah, it is. It kind of gets tacky that way, but I think it's something like I've seen recipes. I think it's like 1 cup masa harina to 3 cups of milk or liquid, and about a cup of sugar. But there are two places I would look for recipes.
Okay.
Okay. Diana Kennedy's books on Mexico and Rick Bayless' book on Mexican food. Both of those authors are probably going to touch on it in one of their books. Hey, Bill, thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And I'll search out these answers.
I hope it helped.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it a lot, man. Thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Ann is on the line. Hey, Ann, what do you want to talk about?
Summer pudding. I just got back from visiting London and went to the Chelsea Flower Show and went to some great restaurants, and one of them being OXO, and everywhere on their menu was summer pudding, and they would always be sold out, and finally got to taste it at the restaurant at OXO and just fell in love with it. So I was hoping that you could give me a good recipe.
Well, first of all, I think, describe to me what you mean by summer pudding.
Well, I guess you would say it's kind of like a bread pudding. It's has breads and then all the different berries, from blueberries, raspberries, I guess you could put currants in them or different things like that. And so it was all soaked up, and they could maybe build it kind of like a trifle, but it was all individual. It was in just little molds, and so all the bread soaked up all the fruit juices.
And it turns red, right?
Yes, and it turns reddish, yes.
It's been around in England forever. I mean, you say summer pudding to most people in England, and they just kind of, everybody knows what it is.
It was on everyone's restaurant, and so we were determined to get it, and they were always sold out. It was just...
Evidently, this is more or less the way you make it. I've seen two kinds of recipes, one where the fruit is cooked and another one where it's not. And it sounds like, I mean, to me, the less you do to great fruit, the better. If you apply heat to it, you lose it. First of all, you do a mix of fruits, and one of the great classics is a lot of raspberries and some red currants, fresh red currants.
All right.
And they're not that easy to find in this country. You know, red currants are real sweet tart. If you can't get them, you can use raspberries and blackberries.
Right.
But you want red fruit, ideally.
Okay.
In the best of all possible worlds, it's red berries. Then what you do is, if you're going to do the uncooked version, you mix the berries with a generous amount of sugar, a pinch of salt, and then you just put them in a bowl and let them stand overnight.
Right.
Okay, because they're going to give off a lot of juice.
Right.
A lot of juice. Then with a slotted spoon or a strainer, drain off the juice. Don't get rid of the juice because you're going to use it later. And what you do is you take a mold like a souffle dish, or as you had it, individual molds. It could be small ramekins.
Right.
And you want to actually line it with slices of day-old bread. And the point here is you have to seal that mold. You know, you don't want gaps in the bread. So what most people do is they cut a round of the bread that fits the bottom of whatever you're using, and then they overlap slices of bread, standing them up around the edges.
Right.
Okay. And I always line any mold, whenever I'm doing this kind of thing, I line it first with plastic wrap because it's very easy to unmold it later. Then what you do is you pack the fruit in there, all right, really pack it in.
Okay.
And then you put bread on the top and you press it. You put it in a shallow pan, something where when stuff runs off, it's going to grab it.
Right.
And what you would do is you would press it so that you put, you know, something heavy, a can or something like that, and you're actually compressing the fruit with the bread. Now, you can either do it where the bread is just the shell, or you can do it where there are layers of the bread in the middle.
Okay.
And then you let it, you chill it overnight, and it's not the easiest thing to cut if you're doing a bigger one.
Right.
But the compressing helps a lot. And one of the things some people do is they take all that juice that the fruit threw off,
mm-hmm.
they boil it down to a syrup.
Okay.
And so the next day, you take it out of the fridge, you serve it chilled, usually.
Right, it was very cold.
Yeah, very, very cold, because that helps keep everything together. And you unmold it, and my method of unmolding it is I just turn the mold out on a plate, and I lift it off, and then I just lift off the plastic wrap. And you put the syrupy fruit over it, and then usually there's a bowl of whipped cream on the side. And that's summer pudding. And the bread has usually become saturated with those garnet-colored juices.
Right.
And it's delicious. It's like concentrated red summer.
Well, I am so glad to talk to you, because I thought of you when I was eating it going, I need to find this recipe.
It's nice to know somebody was in London eating wonderful food thinking of me. One of these days, I'll be in London eating wonderful food, and I promise, Anne, I'll think of you.
All right, bye-bye.
Goodbye. Carrie is on the line. So, Carrie, what do you want to examine today?
Well, thank you for taking my call, first of all. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And I have a question, something that I've heard of before but never actually seen it. It's been showing up in my grocery stores here lately. I live in Memphis, and it's mm-hmm. called jicama. What
oh, yeah.
is it?
Yeah. Oh,
what
yeah.
What is it, and what can I do with it?
Okay. Jicama or jicama, take your pick as to how you want mm-hmm. to pronounce it, comes from Mexico and the Americas, essentially. It's from the tropical part of the Americas. And some people call it Mexican water chestnut.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a brown, round tuber, you know, or root thing.
Okay,
whatever.
Right.
Yeah, and inside it's white and very crunchy and very juicy, and it has a lovely sweet flavor to it. And usually you use it raw.
Okay.
One thing you can do is just cut it into sticks or rounds or whatever size you want and put it into your salads.
Oh, okay.
It's really delicious. But the other thing that they do in Mexico with it is they cut it into sticks or into dice, and they toss it with lime juice, salt, whatever kind of chili that you like, and some orange sections or tangerine sections.
Oh, wow.
And top it with some fresh coriander.
And oh, that sounds wonderful.
It's a delicious salad. You keep that in the fridge and you serve it cool on a very hot summer day. And I know in Memphis, you know from very hot summer days.
Oh, well, yes.
Yeah, I know. You know what I'm saying? This, and by the way, that is really a great accompaniment to something like Memphis barbecue.
Is it? That's what I was wondering. I didn't...
Yeah. Cool,
what,
crunchy?
It didn't feel quite... adventurous enough to taste it without asking you about it first.
Oh, come on. Now, you got to have some courage out
I
there,
know,
Carrie. Come on now.
Now,
come on. Think about the first person to ever eat a spare rib.
Well, there you go.
Yeah, right.
Okay, well, that sounds wonderful. I sure do thank you. That helps a lot.
Bye. Oh, and when you buy them, if they look, you know, like they have any mold or anything like that,
mm-hmm.
Ideally, they're really crisp and they look flawless. But if for some reason they, not that they're soft and mushy, but just if there's a little teeny bit of mold, you can cut that out and the rest of it's just fine.
Oh, okay.
And they'll
okay.
keep several days in the fridge.
Is there any difference in taste? Most of them that I've seen are fairly large.
They're big.
They are all fairly big. Then.
Yeah, I like, I'd say of whatever choice you've got, get the smaller ones.
Okay.
They should feel pretty heavy in your hand.
Okay.
You know, for their size.
Well, that's great, because I had no idea if they were supposed to be cooked or eaten raw.
Some people cook them, but I think they're really great raw.
Wonderful.
Hey,
I
enjoy.
Can't thank you enough.
You are welcome.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
If she's really grateful, she'll send some Memphis barbecue to us. Do you ever think about stuff like, you know, for instance, when you pick up a tin of pepper or cinnamon in the supermarket, I'll bet you don't really consider where it comes from. I mean, we take these things for granted. But somebody had to go out and find those spices. And for companies like the Spice Hunter, an actual person travels where few people have traveled before to track down rare flavorings, just like our ancestors did. In the case of the Spice Hunter, that person is Lucia Cleveland. Lucia, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So, Lucia, what's your background that you got into this?
Biology. I was a biology major who loved to cook.
Sounds like a good combination. But you go out and you hunt down spices. spices and herbs,
right? Yes. Oh, and it's been so exciting.
Lucia, how do you get this stuff into the country?
Well, we are very much on the same side as the government agencies inspecting at the door. So we use our importers who have people living in the land so they can inspect it before it ships. So there's no surprises at the dock in America. So they inspect it before it gets on the boat. It gets on the boat. It goes through quality testing. And it's all made to spec because cleanliness is very important with spices. And it's all, a lot of this is in third world countries, so it does have to be monitored carefully. You know, your black peppercorns can get stepped on and things like that, and you want it to be handled very well. We bring everything in its whole form into the United States so that it can be inspected before it's been ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then we grind it as we need it to our specifications with the type of grinding that preserves the most flavor. It doesn't have too hot of a heat, which will break down the flavor.
So what's the next hunt about?
I think it's going to be Borneo, or we found this wonderful white peppercorn. And white pepper, I always thought, I was wondering, why don't I like white pepper? And this has been something that's been haunting me for 20 years now, because I love black pepper, but I don't like white pepper. It's so musty. Well, in looking into it, white pepper is soaked to remove the hulls. And the soaking process, unless it's done properly, it gets kind of, and the water gets all murky and musty. And that passes into the white peppercorn flavor. So we've found these wonderful growers that in Malaysia that soak it with running water. And that keeps the mustiness out. And so you can have your fleckless white sauces or on your white cream sauces or potatoes, and you can enjoy that white peppercorn flavor without the mustiness.
So what does it taste like if it's different from...
Well, it's got a hotness, and it's got a bit of a citrus note to it, a bit of the juniper. It's creamy white in appearance. And that's important with white pepper. That's graded on color, because often you're using white pepper because of the color.
Well, Lucia, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Lucia Cleveland is founder of the Spice Hunter line of spices. Well, that's the show for today, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week. And remember, call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. The answering machine loves to hear from you. Well, until next week, let me leave you with this tidbit shared by my friend Amelia Saltzman. It seems the Washington Post newspaper had a contest for readers. They asked them to supply alternate meanings for various words. Here's one of the winners. Abdicate. To give up all hope of ever having a flat stomach. Table is brought to you by Club Wed Gift Registry at Target, featuring Henkel's top-of-the-line, fully forged professional cutlery. Henkel's is the knife choice of many professional chefs. To get information on any of the guests you heard here today, simply mail a self-addressed stamped envelope to the Splendid Table, care of Minnesota Public Radio, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. That's the Splendid Table, care of MPR, St. Paul, Minnesota, 55101. Or take a look at our website. That address is splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is produced by Sally Swift. The associate producers are Jennifer Lubke and Jennifer Russell. Our intern is Phoebe Larson. The theme music is by Billy Barber. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Minnesota Public Radio and Tom Bagley Productions. Be sure to join us next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.